You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
A missing child is perhaps a mother's very worst nightmare, but imagine two teenage daughters disappearing without a trace, by their own volition, and refusing to come home. Former Newsweek correspondent Deborah Gwartney lived through this nightmare when her daughters Amanda and Stephanie ran away. She's called her beautifully written new memoir, Live Through This. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and Deborah Gwartney and her daughters, Amanda and Stephanie, join me now to share their stories. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Deborah, your book focuses on the oldest of your four daughters, Amanda and Stephanie. Were the younger two, Molly and Mary, much different?
Oh, well, they were much different as teenagers. They stuck around home, for one thing.
They did right away.
Yeah. But they had, you know, they had their own lively spirits and still do, and they were extremely supportive of me during this time.
The story really begins when you divorced their father. What was your family life like before the divorce and before Stephanie and Amanda ran away from home?
I'd say it was a very normal middle-class life. We, you know, were close family. We did a lot of activities together, and the girls were in lots of dance and art and things like that. They were just happy kids who played a lot and loved each other. Men and Stephanie were very close, wouldn't you say, Steph?
Yes.
But Stephanie, do you think that your parents had different ideas of parenting
from each other?
Mm-hmm.
I suppose, yeah. And when they separated, that became very clear, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, it wasn't just that they separated. You moved to a different part of the country.
We did.
So was that a major part of the problem as well?
Yeah. I think that distance and fissure of a family definitely added to the upset.
From Tucson to Eugene, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And we should bring Amanda in here. Do you want to add anything to this, Amanda?
No. The move was so sudden, it was definitely hard.
How did you feel about the divorce, Amanda?
Well, it was a relief when they first said they were getting separated. There was a lot of fighting at the end, but you know, the change was so drastic that I don't know. It was a hard few years.
Had you gotten along well? I'm asking the both of you, Stephanie and Amanda. Had you gotten along well with your father before the divorce?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So did there sometimes is pressure on kids to side with one parent or another? Did that happen?
Yeah, that happened a lot, actually.
And did you find yourself siding with one more than the other?
No, I didn't. So, it depended on who I was with. You know, I was with my dad, and I felt protective of him, and then would come to my mom with what my dad had said about my mom, and that she would rebuttal. So it was a kind of back and forth, and we were pawns in that.
You're nodding your head.
Oh, yeah, just definitely defending one parent from the other often. That happens.
Would you have preferred it if your mother hadn't moved away from Tucson so you could have had more contact with your father?
I think we would have had a very different life if we had stayed in Tucson. I mean, it's hard to tell or say that, it, you know, we wouldn't have, you know, all of it that we're talking about now in the book wouldn't have transpired necessarily. So,
well, Tucson is so hot, and Eugene is kind of cool. Deborah, when did you begin to notice the effects of the divorce on your daughters?
Well, I probably should have noticed it far long before I did. I was pretty lost in my own kind of, you know, loss and grief and confusion and all of that. And
trying to maintain a career as well.
Right,
as a journalist.
Right, as a journalist, and moved to a new place, raised four little girls, and I guess I got pretty tunnel visioned for a while, and by the time I lifted my head again, I realized my older two daughters had, you know, I'd pushed them away and they'd kind of drifted away, and I had two little girls that I had to spend a lot of time with. That's not an excuse, it just is where my energy went, and I unfortunately sort of lost track of my 13 and 15-year-old daughters by then.
Amanda, you were drawn to the punk counterculture. What drew you to that? Was there a big scene in Eugene, Oregon?
Well, there was a scene. The anti-corporation, anti-society part of it, I guess, being a subculture in a subculture, drew me to it.
Well, Eugene is a university town. This wasn't part of the university culture, was it?
No, not at all.
And Stephanie, what made you follow your older sister into the punk scene?
I'd have to say we entered it at the same time. Sorry, Amanda, I'm taking away the credit.
No.
I think that, it's funny. And Eugene, I'm sure, as you know, there's a sort of a political background to some of that scene, the anarchist scene, as mm-hmm. it's called, or the Eugene anarchists that caused so much upset those years ago.
And but why do you think that is in Eugene of all places?
It's strange. I'm not sure. Maybe it is that cold weather. I think that it's, you know, the environmentalist community is very active and strong there, and out of that came a more direct action approach to activism.
So the two of you started skipping school. What were you doing during the day, Amanda?
At first, we were just drinking beer and hanging out, and wandering around, getting into trouble.
Getting into what kind of trouble?
Oh, I don't know. Trouble that teenagers shouldn't be in. Just, yeah.
Stephanie, you're smiling as though that was just perfectly fine.
The trouble.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't...
It's like you're remembering it with a certain amount of fondness.
Well, who knows what she's referencing, but yeah, I mean, a little bit of fondness.
Were you aware, Debbie, of what your daughters were doing?
No, I dropped them off at school in the morning and watched them walk in the door, and then I'd go to work, but, you know, there was some part of me thinking, they're not going to school, but... I had a sense that things weren't going well there, but I didn't get, it wasn't as if I knew exactly what they were doing. I knew that there was this large counterculture scene in Eugene, and, those kids were on the streets. You could see them, or I could see them. So it didn't surprise me that the girls kind of fell into that scene, because there was a place to go when you left school. It wasn't like it was an empty downtown. There were things to do. There were people to hang out with. There was beer to be purchased.
Mm-hmm. Were you aware that your kids were drinking? They were really underage.
Very underage, yeah. No, I wasn't really aware of that until later. I mean, it slowly seeped in that there was drinking going on.
Is it hard, Stephanie and Amanda, to talk about this time?
Yeah, I would say it's hard, mostly trying to remember.
Because you're such a different person today?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. And just so much happened in such a short period in my life, you know, from 13 to 16. It was jam-packed with travel and events that just sort of, you know, this one on top of the other into this breakdown, I guess, mm-hmm. adding to the breakdown. And it's hard to sort of separate it all out and pick it apart and remember it. I don't know.
That's do you find it hard to talk about, too, Amanda?
I do, yeah, for the same reasons as Stephanie. I was a very innocent 15-year-old. Being the oldest, I didn't really try very much, and then all of a sudden I was living on the streets, and there had been irreplaceable damage done in such a short time.
We have to take a little break. But we'll be back with Deborah Gwartney, who is a former reporter for The Oregonian and also worked as a correspondent for Newsweek for 10 years. She's now on the nonfiction writing faculty at Portland State University. Her book, Live Through This, A Mother's Memoir of Runaway Daughters and Reclaim Love, is published by Harcourt, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Also with us are the two daughters who ran away, Amanda and Stephanie, and we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Deborah Gwartney and her two eldest daughters, Amanda and Stephanie. Ms. Gwartney has written a memoir called Live Through This, a mother's memoir of runaway daughters and reclaimed love, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. So what happened, Debbie, when on the night that your girls left for the first time? Tell me about it.
Well, I'd say the night they left for the first time where we really had a confrontation over it was I'd had a call at work that they hadn't been in school for some weeks, and I knew I had to go home and talk to, you know, figure out what they were doing during the day. That's the first call I got from the school that said they're really not coming to school. So I thought, well, I got to go home and confront this. So I got there, and they were in the bathroom dyeing their hair, and they came out of their room with their backpacks all full, and I knew that they were going and didn't plan to come back. And so we had, you know, we exchanged some harsh and sad words in the living room. And
there was no way to compel them to stay.
No. There was no way to compel them to stay. They were going to go. And the little girls were there and very upset. And so they left, and I got in the car and tried to find them that night, but I didn't find them.
Looking back, do you wish you had reacted differently?
Oh,
handled
sure.
Handled it differently?
Absolutely.
How could you have handled it better?
Not that night, but I wish I'd handled it better months before that. I wish I'd calmly sat down and tried to work it out. We were going to therapy, but that just wasn't working, and I just wish I'd been a lot calmer about the whole thing. I was in an absolute state of panic, which just didn't help us at all.
Amanda, how did you survive? How did you spend your days? Where did you sleep? Where did you get food and money?
Well, we came in and out of the house a lot at first. You know, that first time we left that my mom was referring to, we were only gone for a couple days and then came back. But eventually, when we were gone, we slept in squats, and that's abandoned buildings. Under bridges and parks, and we panhandled sometimes for money. Sometimes people would give us food. Kind of just by the skin of our teeth got by.
It sounds rough. It must have been, didn't the thought of going home offer some kind of comforting, perhaps, you know, you'd be sleeping in your own bed? You wouldn't?
No, not at all. By the time we were definitely not coming home, it just didn't feel like an option anymore.
Can I jump
in? We'd gone too far.
Well, and also, I don't want to confuse the timeline at all, but from the first time we left home, and then we were sort of put into the system, there were a number of things. First, wilderness therapy, and then foster homes. And the second time we left, it was really a fear of being put back into the system. If we did return. And the further away we got, the more likely of a scenario that became.
Now, when you talk about the system, the authorities get involved when kids run away.
Well, no. Mostly my mom making the decision, you know, if we did return, well, obviously you're still troubled kids, so back to the foster home for you. That was, you know, my concern at 14.
The authorities did not get involved. In fact, they refused to get involved.
You say there were many enablers out there who allow children to languish on the streets.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And there aren't many places parents can actually turn for help?
No, that's right. I mean, the police were, you know, they were compassionate about it, but they just, there's no law that requires them to go get runaway children, so they don't. And so I actually hired somebody to go find them on the street, and I paid for, and my ex-husband paid for wilderness therapy, thinking that would kind of bring them around. And then the foster homes were actually, we also paid for that. We arranged that we paid for it. It wasn't through any kind of state system or federal system, but we were just trying to figure out how to get these kids off the street. And, and in fact, it just led them to go get on a train and go farther away.
Is it assumed that children who run away are escaping abusive homes?
Absolutely. It's right there in the
federal law.
They're
trying to protect the kids?
Yep.
And in your case, what were the foster homes like?
I lived with a family in eastern Oregon. They raised cattle for beef.
And you hated it?
I absolutely hated it. Their ideals were the complete opposite of mine.
And I was in... sorry, what'd you say? I was in Montana with, actually, people that were very, very good, kind, nurturing people. I was the lucky one.
But were you upset that you had been separated from each other?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Because this was a joint effort, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. It was. It was a joint effort. Go ahead, Amanda.
Oh, I just was going to say we wouldn't have gone anywhere if it wasn't for the other.
Yes, and the therapist had strongly recommended to me that the girls live in different places for 6 months and see if we could cool this whole thing down. But in fact, as soon as they got together, they hit the streets again.
So do you regret separating them?
You know, I can't really say that I regret anything. My regrets go way back. I wish I had handled things differently long before then. By the time we were in this kind of crisis, I did what I thought I had to do, which was to get them in a safe place with responsible adults. And it was, you know, it was not great. It was awful, but I knew where they were and I knew they were safe.
Amanda, aren't you a farmer these days?
I am, yeah.
So is there any irony in the fact that you hated being with farmers when you were sent to a foster care?
Yeah, I guess there could be irony there. It was more their personalities that was hard to get along with.
And their politics.
I actually loved being around the animals and seeing the animal husbandry. I've always been interested in that. But they would just rail on my mom and me and tell me the environmentalists were, you know, they were very Republican, and it was different than I thought.
So then they were reunited.
Mm-hmm.
Did you fear that they just run off again?
Well, I was hoping that all of this energy and financial expenditure, I was hoping that what we had been working on for the last year would work, but it didn't.
Yeah, and I would have to say, I mean, no terrible criticism to my mother, but, we were on thin ice the moment we got back, you know, and I think that there was a lot of anger from all ends that had been unresolved. But
there are a lot of kids who are, you know, who go through parental divorce, even nastier ones,
right.
Much nastier than the ones that your parents went through. Why do you think you had so much anger?
Well, there was anger, but there was also, I mean, just total lack of communication and really, you know, yeah, they're not that I think that parents should be friends, because I think that it's important to take a disciplinary role as a parent at times.
Are you a parent?
No.
But Amanda is.
Amanda is. But I think that there could have been some more friendship and communication.
Deborah, tell me about when you first found out Amanda was using heroin.
Well, they had jumped on a train. I had no idea where they were then, because the train took them to wherever. And I got a call one night that she'd been picked up in Tucson. They'd made their way by freight train back to Tucson, and someone called me and said she'd been picked up by the EMT the night before, overdosed on heroin. That was the first indication.
And you were there, Stephanie, weren't you?
I was.
Mm-hmm. What was your reaction? Were you obviously you were worried about your sister, but was there anything you could do? You were still a kid.
Yeah. No, it was definitely takes the top. The worst day of my life. So
she wasn't just a kid; she was 14 years old.
Amanda, had you become addicted to heroin?
I had, yeah.
Was that the end of it for you?
An overdose
can be a rather dramatic experience.
Yeah, it was a huge eye-opener. It was kind of the end of everything for me. I a few weeks later, after I detoxed off the heroin, I was sitting on the street, and a police officer asked me my name, and I knew that if I gave him my real name, I would get taken in, and I gave him my real name. I couldn't do it anymore.
So,
That's when I got
so
the call.
Amanda wound up back with you, but mm-hmm. Stephanie stayed off on her own.
Mm-hmm.
What were you doing, Stephanie?
I traveled mm-hmm. for another year.
A whole year?
9 months, about, yeah.
You
by freight train. You know, this isn't traveling by bus.
These are the years that people get their education. What kind of education were you getting?
A better one than a lot of people get in public school. I don't know. A lot of reading.
Wait, are you recommending that we all
absolutely not? Absolutely not. I wish that, you know, there are many valuable things about the experience that, and you know, the whole negative side definitely overshadows all of that. But I wish I could have done it, you know, 5 years later and did the whole hobo, you know, train hopping.
Because it can be very dangerous, can't it?
It can, yeah, especially as a woman.
Mm-hmm. A young, vulnerable girl, pretty.
Yeah, well, I think that both Amanda and I were not terribly naive, but we're maybe some false bravery, but we were safe. I mean, we made safe decisions for the most part.
And then you decided to call home?
Call home.
How did you
After
wind up?
After 9 months, you called home.
Well, yeah.
And why was that? You just had enough of it?
No. Well, I got back in touch after a period.
Her dog was sick.
That is not. Yeah. My dog was sick, but that wasn't the first time I called. But yeah, I was in touch and I was living my life separate from my family. Mm-hmm. But.
So when you were reunited, how did you heal?
It was a slow process, and you know, it. I guess if it was a television show, we would have all run together and held each other in great relief, and there was relief, but it was also there was so much hurt by then that it took us a very long time to kind of crawl slowly back into each other's lives. I mean, it was. During the time that Stephanie was still missing, I'd say Amanda and I really built a new bond, which I know I hugely value and cherish. And then Stephanie and I did that later when she was back in school and things like that. And, you know, I think what I've figured out is that forgiveness has its own timeline, and the first thing that had to happen, as Amanda has said several times, is that we had to learn how to trust each other.
Was writing this memoir part of the healing process?
Absolutely. For me, it was. I can't speak for the girls, but it's been...
Did they give you input?
Yes, I asked them for input. And also, just to look at my own role and what I had done to cause this was hugely healing for me.
Well, obviously, you've worked it out because all three of you are talking about this book. And you seem to be getting along again. Mm-hmm. Amanda, you are a mother. How would you deal with the possibility that your daughter might run away from home?
Well, I like to think that I have a much better support system than my mom had. And just the fact that I have this experience in my mom, I feel like I could head it off pretty early. I won't let it happen, and I know my mom wouldn't either.
And what advice would you give Stephanie to a parent who had kids who were acting out?
Oh, gosh. As, you know.
Well, I mean, you know how you were reacting to the things your mother was doing, and she's obviously an intelligent person who mm-hmm. tried all the things that I probably would try.
Right. Well, not being, I'm not a mother, so I don't know that sensation, and I know, yeah.
Yeah. There's a certain amount of power that a teenage girl needs to feel in control of her life, and I think finding a healthy way to, for teenagers in general, to express their power over their life, I think that's really important.
I agree. That's what I wish I had done. So wish that I had recognized that they needed to express them. Each of them needed to express herself in a way that was not conventional. And I so wish I had allowed that, found ways for them to do that, but I just didn't have those resources at that time.
Do you have any sense of how common this experience is?
There are 2.8 million runaway children on the streets of the United States. I think it's pretty common.
Hmm. How many of them did you run into when you were on the run, Stephanie?
On the run.
Well, whatever, while you were living this
traveling.
Life.
Traveling.
I think it's a... I'll try to break it down quickly, but there's, you know, a kind of a tribe or community that travels around the country, and oftentimes you see the same people in multiple towns. But, we weren't really part of the whole runaway scene. A lot of people that we were spending time with had permission from their parents or...
had been thrown out.
Had been thrown out, were over 18, a number of different scenarios. But that the whole runaway shelter culture that my mom assumed that we were, you know, staying in the shelters and, you know, with the street kids, we weren't really a part of that. So I can't really speak on that experience of shelter runaway kids.
I guess it's a hierarchy I still don't really understand, but...
Amanda, any last words?
No.
Well, then, thank you all for being with us, Amanda, Stephanie, and Deborah Gwartney, Gwartney. Mm-hmm. Her book, Live Through This, A Mother's Memoir of Runaway Daughters and Reclaimed Love, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. It's been really interesting talking with you.
Thank you so much.